Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Chris Wellborn joins us here for the next 25 minutes. Mormons and the Early Church Fathers. Why are Mormons studying the Church Fathers? We'll talk about that here for the next few minutes. Then, at the bottom of the hour, we're joined by Dr. Nathan Jastrom. We're going to talk about this biblical scroll, this fragment found in Israel. It's made the news. You may have heard about it. And then in the third hour of the program, we've got a long ways to go in that third hour. Wendy Wright joins us to talk about President George W. Bush's nomination of John Roberts to the Supreme Court. Wendy, of course, is Senior Policy Director for Concerned Women for America. We're finding out what she has to say, as well as getting her reaction to some things that Nancy Kenan, who is the president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, had to say about that appointment earlier today. Then Eric Rotman and Pastor Randy Asbury will be our guest for the remainder of that third hour. We're going to talk about Christ in you. Chris Wellborn is a Ph.D. candidate in patristic theology at Marquette University. He's author of an article in the latest edition of the Christian Research Journal titled Mormons and Patristic Study, How Mormons Use the Church Fathers to Defend Mormonism. Chris, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Okay, I am a Lutheran, and I understand why Lutherans cherish the Church Fathers. Our Confessions, the Book of Concord, quote the Church Fathers over and over again. Roman Catholics, I can understand why they cherish the Church Fathers. They take a lot of stock in that. And, of course, Orthodoxy as well cherishes the Church Fathers.
Right.
Why are Mormons studying the Church Fathers?
They're studying the Church Fathers typically to bolster their sect or denomination as the most truly divine.
Now, is this always been the case for Mormons, that they've had an interest in post-apostolic early church writings and theologians?
No, it started late in the 19th century with B.H. Roberts, and then was quickly picked up on by John Widsoe and James Talmage, two other apostles in the Mormon church.
Now, I was under the impression, Chris, that, and I think I'm right in this, that the standard LDS theology is in many ways predicated on the notion that the Christian church apostatized very early.
Right.
After the death of the apostles, and remained essentially in a dark age until Joseph Smith revived the church.
Right.
So how do they take an interest in the church fathers if this is basically representative of apostasy?
Well, Roberts, back in the late 19th century, he looked at the church fathers, and he was borrowing from some European liberals of his time period, but he was using the argument that an apostasy occurred and that the theology and the moral conduct of the early church reflected a Hellenistic incursion into pure Christian truth. And the actual using church fathers in a positive way, trying to find similarities with them, didn't occur until Hugh Nibley later in the middle of the 20th century.
So are Mormon scholars today searching the early church fathers for evidence of the apostasy, or are there other reasons they might be also searching the early church fathers?
Really, both. The Mormon academic Kent Jackson wrote a book called From Apostasy to Restoration, and obviously just from the title, he's very focused in that book on finding error in the patristic period. And then other people have produced material trying to find positive similarities. And so on one hand, the negative illustrates how the church went bad and hence sets the stage for the Mormon Restoration. And then the similarities, they say, were remnants of true Christianity, which is really a proto-Mormonism, that was being choked out of existence by Catholic orthodoxy as it became the politically dominant force.
So in some ways, the Mormons here, the Mormon scholars, are using the study of the early church fathers in a similar way as some New Age groups use them. In other words, the New Age groups say, look, I think that Christianity originally embraced reincarnation. And so they go looking around in the church fathers because they find even a hint of something that sounds like reincarnation. So there you go. There's evidence that at one time they really believed it, but it was waning at that point. It was being choked out
right.
by other things.
And it's just an inductive assumption that they're making that the belief, so-called, that seems to be similar with their modern views actually was the same. It's just a begging the question assumption that, I found a parallel or something that looks like a parallel to something I believe. Well, it must therefore be the same thing.
Doesn't it also beg the question if the Mormon says, okay, I'm going to go looking for evidence of an apostasy, and if you define apostasy as Orthodox Christianity, surprise, surprise, a lot of the church fathers are Orthodox Christians, but that doesn't prove it. It was apostasy, does it?
No, I don't think so. The whole concept of what they're doing is just reading a modern measuring stick backwards in time and trying to find error, things that don't measure up to their modern Mormon measuring stick, and positive apparent similarities that they use as bolstering blocks to justify their existence.
So when Mormon scholars today go looking, let's talk about the second part of it, I guess. When they go looking in the church fathers for evidence of nascent Mormonism or Mormonism in the stages of being choked out by an apostasy,
right.
What in particular are they looking for? What kind of issues or doctrines, Mormon doctrines, are they looking for among the church fathers?
Basically, anything that parallels their modern beliefs. God as a human, God physical, God having form, and I'm speaking of God the Father. Also, aspects of salvation in the patristic period seem to parallel Mormon beliefs to a large extent. That is, salvation by self-effort. Other areas might be premortal existence, origin in the third century, believed in a premortal existence. Other persons believe that matter was eternal, and so their cosmology, they find similarities in that, and concepts of authority. So the priesthood, a pretty heavy-handed hierarchical structure, similarities in that regard, and so forth.
Do they find any evidence, or do they purport to find any evidence, of one of the major historical claims of LDS theology, that being that that Jesus makes appearances on the American continent or elsewhere on the globe to bring a dispersed tribe of Israel back into the fold?
No, not that I know of. Nothing of that type of information I've read or found that they've found parallels with. So
where do they purport, if you could name some fathers and some possible teachings, where in the church fathers do they purport to have discovered God, that is, God the Father, as being human or having possessed a body or something along those lines?
Right, and actually God the Father as being human, that's too far of a stretch even for what's available in the church fathers, but God the Father as being material, they found evidence in a 2nd to 3rd century writer, Tertullian of Carthage. And Tertullian, probably from a Stoic background, believed that everything in existence has materiality. And quite similar to Mormon beliefs that there's crude materiality and there's fine materiality, and God, or the spirit realm, has a finer type of materiality, but still material nevertheless. And then humans and other crude objects like that we see or deal with on Earth would have that less fine form of materiality.
Now, is it that these fathers were genuinely mistaken with regard to the nature of God, and that's what the Mormons are detecting here? Or are they misinterpreting what the fathers originally meant to say by these things?
Well, I think that Tertullian positively did believe in God the Father as a material being, but that if you're going to assume by that that he meant that God the Father was a human-shaped, basically a promoted human, like what Mormonism advances, that's the jump that's simply unsustainable. So it's one thing to find certain people, another person, Methodius and perhaps Lactantius, late 3rd century, believed that the human soul perhaps was finally material. And so to assume by that that, oh, the human soul has shape and God the Father having a human soul is also human-shaped, I mean, that's a huge logical jump. That's simply not what those persons asserted. So they're actually taking little bits, like Tertullian and his God must be made of some sort of materiality, and then reading their modern Mormon view of God as just a basically promoted human into Tertullian's. It's basically proof texting the church fathers, which is what Mormonism has done with the Bible since its inception. You don't find too many Mormons who know too much about Zephaniah or Habakkuk or books outside their missionary path. But of course, if you go to the passages that support aspects or apparently support aspects of Mormon theology and practice, they're fairly fluent on those passages. And it's the same thing here. They're combing through, really, at Hugh Nibley's, Hugh Nibley being the father of Mormon use of patristic sources, but combing through the patristic sources and finding these gleanings or glimmers of similarity that they then hang their hat on more than they ought to.
We're talking with Chris Wellborn, a PhD candidate in patristic theology at Marquette University, and author of an article in the latest edition of the Christian Research Journal titled Mormons and Patristic Study, How Mormons Use the Church Fathers to Defend Mormonism. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In about 10 minutes, we're going to be joined by Dr. Nathan Jastrom to discuss this biblical scroll, a fragment. I think it's a fragment or two that was found in Israel very recently. We'll find out what that's all about. Dr. Jastrom has done extensive research and written several articles on the Dead Sea Scrolls. Chris, the other issue that you bring up in your article in the Christian Research Journal that Mormons believe is fruitful search in the early church fathers has to do with the notion of deification. And this
right.
is a little trickier because there are a lot of early church fathers, and then those who read them, even say the Orthodox, who speak of a kind of deification, a theosis. What are they finding there, and what do they think they're finding? What are they really finding?
Well, certain church fathers wrote things that sound very similar to what Mormonism seems to teach. That is, we will one day become God. We will one day become gods. And they use this terminology that externally sounds similar to what Mormonism advances. But even Mormon scholars differ with what the patristic writers actually meant. Some of them understand, I believe, that the patristic writers did not mean by that terminology the same thing that Mormonism advances, and others just equivocate and use the similarity in terminology and say, essentially, see, they believed that we can become gods. We believe that you can become gods. People think they were Christians. Why don't you think we're Christians? And so Irenaeus in the second century, for example, used this terminology in the preface to one of his books, Against Heresies, and he made a statement that seems to imply that Jesus became what man is so that man can one day be what Jesus is, or others have interpreted that to mean become God. Well, Irenaeus, in over 70 places in his writings, asserts the actual existence of only one true God. And so either Irenaeus was contradictory, saying on one hand, there's one God, and on the other hand, we can become God, or he meant something different by using deification terminology than what the Mormons are assuming he meant.
Now, one other interesting aspect of this, and I think it's probably fair to mention this, that although the motives of these scholars, these Mormon scholars, as they look into the early church fathers, may well be sectarian and apologetic for Mormonism, as you write, there is some fruitful study being done by these Mormons in the early church fathers. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I'd also add, not just in patristic studies, but intertestamental, that is, Dead Sea Scrolls and Nag Hammadi and other areas, they have competent, trained scholars who are producing reasonable work in patristics and in those areas as well. One scholar, S. Kent Brown, has worked with Egyptian Christianity around the time of the patristic era, and he has a publication where he analyzes several fragments in a community, an isolated community in patristic era Egypt, and his conclusions are solid conclusions and actually bring insight to the period. He was actually, in his article, slipping in things that an outsider, that is a person who doesn't know much about Mormonism, wouldn't understand, but actually which implicitly supports Mormonism. That is, in this particular Egyptian community, we found a fragment that mentions that God the Father is the father of all human spirits, and it's from a inscription dating from the 10th century in Nubia, but it's in Greek. Well, in Nubia, they didn't speak or write Greek in that time period, so he infers that it was a liturgical text that had sacred value from a much earlier period. The point being, the teaching that people thought that God was the father of the human spirits in a Mormonistic type of way was an actually ancient, regarded teaching among the later Nubian community, and so forth. So good scholarship, but even so, with implicit agenda, if you read between the lines a little bit.
Let's talk near the end of our conversation here, Chris, about several more general subjects that this raises, I think, for those who are paying attention to what the Mormons are doing. The first and foremost being Mormon apologetics. We've talked with other guests regularly on the program on the subject of Mormonism, and all of them agree that it is not a good idea to simply dismiss Mormon apologetics as though, their theology is so obviously wrong, therefore, we just don't need to take them seriously at all. While we would disagree with their theology, they are a force to be contended with in some cases, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah, they're. I would say BYU is one of the top language institutions around the world, very focused on languages, obviously because of their missionary program. And they have a strong classics department. They have a strong biblical languages department. And so they have competent scholars trained in the languages who are able to put out and are putting out good quality scholarship. But along with that is the constant agenda that seems to be promoted, where the things that they look at tend to lean towards those areas that implicitly or explicitly will support Mormonism's claim of being the truest Christian church.
And I guess I got to wonder, as you look at this, do you see an attempt? I think it's being done popularly through kind of an advertising push on the part of the main LDS church to depict Mormonism as more mainstream Christian. Do you see a similar bent among the Mormon scholars who are looking for explicit Mormon doctrines in the church fathers?
Absolutely. And the constant argument is, you people think these church fathers were Christians who believed that these types of things, whether it was pre-existence with Origen in the 3rd century, or whether it was God as being material with Tertullian in the 2nd to 3rd century, or Augustine with his notions of grace, or whatever. And we believe these things as well. You think they're Christians, why don't you give us the same credit of being Christians also? Stephen Robinson is kind of at the forefront of Mormon scholars advancing this type of argumentation right now, BYU scholar.
And then, since you're doing your work in patristics, I got to ask, I think everyone suffers in every tradition, probably, to talk about now within the pale of Orthodox Christianity. from a sloppy approach to the fathers. And that would be, look, I'm just going to go looking for what I want to find in the fathers rather than taking them as a whole, good, bad, and ugly.
Right.
Because the fathers obviously can't be taken as a monolithic presentation of beliefs because they're not monolithic. How should we all be rightly, responsibly reading the church fathers? The Mormons are obviously doing kind of an irresponsible job in most cases. How should we Christians be rightly reading them?
Yeah, and frankly, I don't see our approach, or I should say a conservative Protestant approach, I don't see as being much different. We tend to proof text and comb through and, oh, that's a cool passage, or that's a passage that aligns with what I believe. I just feel like we should try to get into the minds of whoever we're looking at and forget about what we personally believe and just try to figure out what this person was thinking and believing and perhaps why and how he was putting things together and fitting it all in.
So let the church fathers speak for themselves whether we like what they have to say or not.
Right, absolutely.
A real quick phone call here as our conversation winds down. This one comes from Kurt calling from his car. Kurt, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, thank you. I guess my question is, how do these Mormon scholars, if they truly are scholars, as you say, how do they deal with the nonsense of Joseph Smith's crazy life and Brigham Young's crazy life and all the fighting and the armies and all the wives and all the crazy golden glasses and the lies and deceptions and all the history that they claim, you know, all the stuff in the Book of Mormon that's about stuff that took place in the Americas that there's never one ounce of shred of evidence for? Or how do they deal with all that craziness?
Thank you very much, Kurt. Well, how do bona fide scholars, is it a source of embarrassment for them, much of what is claimed there? With 1 minute.
You're asking me.
Yeah, for you, Chris.
Yeah, I don't believe that deception is something that comes with intellect. I believe that it's just something that transcends all intellect and all, you know, colors, creeds, races, or whatever. And so, you know, we have the same kind of stuff in our backgrounds variously, whether you be Lutheran or Peter fighting Paul in Galatians or whatever. And I don't know that historical difficulties like that are something that's proportionally related, really, to the intellect and people actually having the knowledge and the academic ability to see truth or non-truth through those types of historical circumstances.
Chris Wellborn is a PhD candidate in patristic theology at Marquette University, author of this article in the latest edition of the Christian Research Journal titled Mormons and Patristic Study, How Mormons Use the Church Fathers to Defend Mormonism. And Chris, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Thanks very much.
We're going into this next conversation with Dr. Nathan Jastrom on a biblical scroll found in Israel. Very anxious to hear more about that. Something we also ought to keep in mind as we're going through all these subjects today, and that is the pressing need that remains worldwide and here in our nation for Christ-centered, cross-focused relief efforts, the kind that are put forth by LCMS World Relief. For more information about LCMS World Relief, you can find their logo at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or contact them here in St. Louis, area code 314-996-1683, 314-996-1683, LCMS World Relief.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
We hear preaching that focuses on lifestyle, the kind of sermon that speaks of 10 principles of Christian money management or 7 steps to Christian parenting. And that's all in the way of the law.
Pastor John Pless, author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for July, Handling the Word of Truth, on the danger of abandoning law and gospel preaching.
And so people do not hear that consoling and sweet message that we have forgiveness of sins through the blood of Jesus Christ and that we can rest our confidence in Him alone.
For more information about our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for July, Handling the Word of Truth, Law and Gospel in the Church Today, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Conservatives are thrilled with the choice of John Roberts to replace Sandra Day O'Connor on the U.S. Supreme Court. Judge Roberts, who sits on the D.C. Court of Appeals, is being called exceptional, a legal superstar, and a man who will interpret the Constitution. When President Bush announced his choice to the nation, he quickly got the attention of the right.
He will strictly apply the Constitution and laws, not legislate from the bench.
Sean Rushton of the Committee for Justice called Roberts a great, great pick.
I think it's a big victory for anyone who thinks that the Supreme Court has badly overstepped its legitimate authority over the last several decades.
But conservatives are still cautious, primarily because they've been burned in the past. In 2002, during his confirmation hearings for the Federal Appeals Court, Roberts said he had no personal views that would prohibit him from applying Roe v. Wade. Matt Staver of Liberty Counsel wants to know what that means.
Did he mean that as an appellate court judge, he would be bound to apply the precedent? If that's the case, that poses no problem. But does he mean that he would be having no personal or moral convictions opposition to Roe versus Wade? If that's the case, he's going to be opposed.
Despite that question, Staver says Roberts appears to have a conservative track record and is opposed by all the right groups.
The National Abortion Rights Action League opposes him. The Alliance for Justice combined 300 law professors to oppose him when he was nominated. So clearly they believe that he would be someone who would overturn Roe versus Wade.
While the left will attack, Jay Sekulow of ACLJ expects Senate confirmation.
He was confirmed by unanimous consent with a voice vote at the United States Senate. I don't think it could be any better. John Roberts will sail through.
Sekulow says John Roberts is the best example of the president's judicial philosophy. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Dining with sinners. That's what happens every Sunday at Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. The Lord Jesus himself comes and spreads his banquet table before us, sinners. Not a target group of professionals, but sinners in need of the one thing that only he can give, the forgiveness that he won for us at the cross. Christian, seeker, unbeliever, it doesn't matter. All those who are burdened by their sin and hungry for God's forgiveness are invited to visit Bethany Lutheran Church, 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview.
You know, it's possible to read an excerpt of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July on our website, issuesetc.org. It's titled, Handling the Word of Truth, Law and Gospel in the Church Today. More information is available from Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Handling the Word of Truth by Pastor John Pless, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to be talking with you. An open lines question that I want your answer to tomorrow on the program. Should Christians read Harry Potter? The new book is out everywhere you go. You walk into the grocery store, there's a pile of them. You walk into Walmart, there's a pile of them. You go to the bookstore, they're everywhere. And, of course, I think later this year, the next movie is coming out as well. Should Christians be reading Harry Potter? And we'll also talk about how the media tries to separate your children from your values. Rod Dreher, it's been such a long time since we talked with Rod of the Dallas Morning News, will join us. We'll also be talking with David Mills of Touchstone Magazine about the tendency in the church to become a bureaucracy. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. Well, the headline reads, a scroll fragment, a biblical scroll found in Israel. Dr. Nathan Jastrom joins us to talk about this find. I take it from the news that it's somewhat rare. He's professor of theology at Concordia University in Wisconsin, and he's also done extensive research and written several articles on the Dead Sea Scrolls. Dr. Jastrom, welcome back to Issues Etc.
It's nice to be here, Todd.
What's the story here? What has been found, or at least uncovered, in Israel?
It's a really rather remarkable find. After the flurry of Dead Sea Scroll discoveries back in 1947, ending up with 1956, we really haven't discovered other examples of scrolls that came from right around the time of Jesus, maybe up to a couple hundred years before, down to about 40 years after his death or so. And so to have two new fragments appear from the region right around Ein Gedi is really a rather remarkable find. That region around Ein Gedi is one that has a camp by the Dead Sea shore. So if we have people listening to the show who visited the Dead Sea and who've swum in the Dead Sea, they've probably camped very, very close or swum very, very close to where these scrolls were discovered. They were discovered in a place called Nahal Arugot, which is one of the two streams that flow right around Ein Gedi. And the scrolls come from right around the time of the Bar Kokhba revolt, which is about 135 A.D.
What do they tell us? Do you know any of the content?
Yes. The scrolls have been, the images of the scrolls have now been published on the web. And so I was able to take a look at what the content of those scrolls was. And here's the portions of Leviticus that they include. One fragment has portions of about 8 words, and it comes from Leviticus 23, verses 38 to 39. And then the other fragment has fragments of words coming from just below that in the column, from chapter 23, verses 40 to 44, and then includes a few words from the next column as well, which turns out to be chapter 24, verses 16 to 18. Now, the content of those passages, the first couple of sections come from the portion in Leviticus talking about the Feast of Tabernacles. It talks about how the people are to bring their offerings to God during the tabernacles, and how they are to take these palm fronds and leafy branches and poplars and rejoice and celebrate it before the Lord and to live in joy with that remembrance of how God took care of them when he brought them out of Egypt. So that's the first portion, the content of the first portion. And the content of the very last segment, the few words from the next column that came through, are the end of the section about putting to death people who blaspheme the name of God, and the beginning of the section that we call the Lex Talionis, the law of retribution. Basically, it says an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. So two very interesting passages that come from right around the same segment of Leviticus on two fragments from the same scroll. Those are what were discovered.
I'm just curious, do we know at this point, are they like the Dead Sea Scrolls in their composition in that have they been examined sufficiently enough to say, okay, this isn't the same family of scrolls that we would find in the Dead Sea Scrolls? Are they made of the same stuff? Or how big are these fragments? What does it look like?
Yeah, I haven't held them and looked at them directly. I've only seen the images that have appeared on the Internet, so it's hard to be definitive. In fact, when I first looked at one of these scrolls, I was rather suspicious about the writing because one letter was made in a way that just didn't look right for the writing from that period. But after looking at the picture some more, I realized that what I thought was some ink may just be a shadow in the photograph. It's just really hard to tell without examining the physical evidence itself. So we do have to keep open the possibility that these are forgeries, but on the surface of it, the pictures, they look like they're the real thing.
Now, obviously, if they were forgeries, nothing earth-shattering would result, except that someone would get taken for a lot of money here. I mean, that would be the motive for the forgery, I would think, because I take it that the texts in no way differ from the standard Masoretic text or any other more reliable biblical text we have from Leviticus.
That's right. As I looked at the words that were preserved there, there's no new reading there. Everything is where you would expect it to be. So nothing very exciting in the sense of different readings are being proposed. And the motive for forgery generally is money or fame. In this case, not a whole lot of money was paid. It was about $3,000 that was paid for these two fragments. But they are very small fragments. You could easily contain the smaller fragment by putting your forefinger against your thumb and just looking at the space that makes. The larger fragment, if you made your forefinger and thumb somewhat large, maybe not touching each other, that would still cover about the size of the larger fragment.
Now, let's talk about the whole issue of forgery, because we've seemed to be, just on almost a monthly basis, getting a story out of the Antiquities Authority of Israel that they're looking at another thing that was put forward, and it seems to be kind of a going business over there. We had the ossuary of James, the brother of Jesus. And we also had, I think, a couple other tablets or something along those lines, maybe a bell or another kind of artifact, that now everyone's immediately suspicious of these things, since one has been shown, or at least believed to be a forgery.
Yes, those forgeries are a bane in our discipline, because they corrupt the data that we work with. As we're finding genuine artifacts, we look at the style of the writing, we look at the content, and that becomes one solid piece of evidence from that point in history. But when you get a forgery in there, suddenly you're introducing things that aren't real, and it throws off the analysis of all other finds from that point. So archaeologists are very unhappy with the forgeries that have come out. The main ones that have been exposed recently include that ossuary of the James, the brother of Jesus, but they also include objects that I myself have taught in my classes as being genuine examples of ancient artifacts. For instance, the pomegranate scepter head of ivory, which was on display in the Israel Museum. This pomegranate scepter head was proclaimed to be perhaps the only surviving artifact from Solomon's temple that we possess. It had an inscription on it that said, "Holy of the priests in the house of Yahweh," and it seemed like it probably came from a robe of one of the priests. But then the Israeli Department of Antiquities announced that that was a forgery, that people had simply scratched those letters in place. Another one that I had taught in my classes as being an authentic find was a seal of the scribe of Jeremiah himself, Baruch. We have that seal that was preserved. And now they've found that seal of Baruch is most likely a forgery. So these are the reasons why even the archaeologists who reported this find said normally archaeologists don't buy artifacts. They like to dig them up from the ground. They don't like to promote illegal trade in these artifacts, and they don't want to be taken by forgeries. But as this archaeologist said, the temptation is just too strong. The urge to preserve this material from further decay or from deportation out of the land is just too great. And so he did end up purchasing these two fragments for $3,000.
Set this in its context. First of all, in the context of, and it's well known that for about 10 years, they were pulling ancient texts out of the Dead Sea location. From about 1947 onward, for about a decade, they were pulling stuff out hand over fist, and it was unbelievable. It was an explosion of textual finds there. And then, nothing. They pretty much combed through everything. How are these found?
Well, these come from what are called refugee caves right around En Gedi, one of the two streams coming by En Gedi. And we believe that at the time the Bar Kokhba revolt was taking place, and let me give you a little bit of the history there. Emperor Hadrian decided that he was going to remake the city of Jerusalem into a Roman city, rename the thing, banish Jews from living there, the whole nine yards. And, of course, the Jews could not agree to that, and they developed a rebellion. They tried to rebel against Rome. And in the process, the Romans came in and, again, caused a lot of destruction in Israel. So the fighters who were fighting against Rome would retreat into these caves, much like David retreated into caves in the same area when he was running away from Saul. There are caves just dotting the hillsides. There's all over the place. And it's likely then that as these people were hiding from the Romans who were coming to destroy them, they also brought along with them some of their precious scrolls and left them in the caves, hoping that perhaps at least they would not fall into Roman hands. So later, then, the shepherds in the area, the Bedouin, will comb through all these caves looking for any artifacts. And they find scrolls, they find other artifacts, pieces of bronze, they find sandals, cooking ware, implements that these people used to live in the caves while they were hiding from the Romans. And you can imagine how the Bedouin search all the caves that they can find, because each of these objects is worth a lot of money, and if they can sell that to the archaeologists, then they can make an extra living that way. But as soon as they find something, then the archaeologists come in, who would much prefer to find the objects themselves so they could note where it is in the cave and be sure that it came from the cave, that it was not a forgery. So both archaeologists and Bedouin have been searching the caves throughout the Dead Sea area for decades. The problem is we don't have a lot of artifacts from that time, and the fact that any have survived this long is really a miracle.
And then, if you would, just give us an idea to set this in the context of the Dead Sea discoveries. How would you describe the Dead Sea Library that is eventually uncovered here and now has become so very valuable, especially to Old Testament and intertestamental study?
The Dead Sea Scrolls is a huge library of scrolls from a couple hundred years before Christ until about 40 years after his death. And in that library are roughly 1,000 manuscripts. Now, what we've just discovered, or what has just been discovered, these two Leviticus fragments from the same scroll, that's a very small part of the total mass of discovery. And yet, every little fragment from that survives this many years is a very valuable find. So it doesn't advance our knowledge all that much, but it is exciting to realize there still are some fragments out there. Some people had been giving up hope that we'd ever find any more fragments from that time. Now it seems likely that maybe we'll keep turning up occasionally a fragment here or there. To find another hoard like we found at Qumran, that's probably hoping too much, since you have to have a settlement, you have to have a group of people responsible for hiding their treasures in a cave like this, and they've searched all the obvious places to search already, so it's unlikely that we'll find just thousands and thousands of fragments like we found at Qumran, but a fragment here and there, a sandal here and there, a cooking implement, that type of thing, we probably will continue to find as more and more of these caves are searched more carefully.
Another side of the whole Dead Sea Scroll saga, at least at its inception, is this ascetic community, this, you could almost call it a B.C. Jewish monastery in some ways, this community of the Essenes. Who were they?
The people who lived at Qumran were most likely people called Essenes, one of the three major Jewish groups of that time. There's some debate about this. Some scholars don't buy into that theory, but most of us who've done serious work on the scrolls still think that the Essene hypothesis is the one that accounts for most of the information in the most satisfactory manner. These Essenes are known to be the strictest of the three major groups. When they would have controversies about what is ritually clean or unclean, the Essenes would take the strictest possible interpretation and require even more care in keeping their objects ritually clean. They required daily washings, daily baptisms. They had what we think of as a sort of a mother church. Of course, they wouldn't have called it a mother church then, but they had a central community at Qumran, and it's likely that central community did not allow women to be part of the community, although there are some graves with women's bones in them there. The thought is maybe those were visitors or some other explanation that we're not certain about. But some of their writings say that they do not have marriage in that central community. But they also had other communities throughout the land, communities right on the southern side of southwestern side of Jerusalem, and communities scattered throughout the land. in which the rules were somewhat relaxed. They would have people who lived with wives and families. They would just have certain characteristics that separated them from other Jews, and yet they were able to live in a closer conformity and in a closer proximity to them. The ones at Qumran separated themselves because they were convinced that the regular Jews were unclean, that their priests were illegitimate, and they were waiting for the end times for the Messiah to come and lead them back to take over Jerusalem and to restart a clean worship of God again.
Now, it is that strong messianic expectation that one finds in those B.C. Essenes that have led some to speculate that John the Baptist, who we meet in the New Testament, either was an Essene or fell under the influence of their teachings at some point. Where do you come down on that?
Well, John the Baptist was operating very close to where the Essenes had their community, and of all the possible Essenes, the theories that have been put forward, John the Baptist would be the one that would fit more evidence than the other possibilities that have been mentioned. And yet, it's impossible for John the Baptist to have been an Essene at the time that he was preaching about Jesus Christ. So the only possibility is that perhaps part of his childhood might have been spent there. That's highly speculative. I don't think that there's any need to agree to that, but some people believe that he spent part of his childhood there. I think it's more likely that John the Baptist and the Essenes both understood the Old Testament in a similar way, and that actually Jesus understood the Old Testament in a similar way, understanding some passages to be messianic, talking about baptism as being important, talking about a holy meal that would be shared among believers. So there are similarities between John the Baptist and his teaching and Jesus and what the Essenes were teaching. But there were differences that would have been sure to disrupt any fellowship between them. John the Baptist met and talked with and moved among other Jews. For the Essenes, this would have made him unclean. They would not have welcomed him back into their camp when he would move around with other Jews like that. And their baptisms do differ. John the Baptist's was a baptism for repentance, for the remission of sins. The Essenes' baptism was more for ritual purity rather than for cleansing from moral guilt.
Finally here, is it possible that, you know, we've talked about the Bar Kokhba revolt, the time in which probably these scrolls and the fragments that were recently discovered in Israel all hidden away at some point there. Is it possible that there is another horde someplace connected to, say, perhaps the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., some hundreds of years afterwards, that would be sitting there awaiting some Bedouin or some enterprising archaeologist to simply walk in and find a similar find where people have said, look, these writings are our scriptures and valuable to us, and we're going to hide them away from the destruction that's coming.
Absolutely. There's a high possibility, I believe, a high probability that there are such finds, especially around the holy city of Jerusalem. The best thing we could do, archaeologically speaking, with Jerusalem, is to evacuate all the people living in Jerusalem and then do a controlled archaeological excavation, digging down through the centuries to find all the treasures that are hidden and buried in that area. That just will never happen. Politically speaking, it's impossible to take over a city like that and just use it for scientific research. So what we do have is some individuals who have a very high interest in uncovering Israelite history. They will buy houses in the old city of Jerusalem and then conduct unauthorized excavations in the basements of their own houses. One man has opened up a whole museum based on excavations in his own basement, and he digs up finds from ancient times, even going back to the time of David. So clearly, there are incredible riches still to be found. One area that would be wonderful to explore would be the caverns beneath the Temple Mount. But if any news comes out that somebody is trying to explore those caverns, that's cause for a riot. It could lead to a war, as Muslims understand that area to be holy to their religion, and Orthodox Jews understand that to be holy to their religion, you end up stepping on a powder keg as you try to uncover portions of the past. That's why most of the major finds today around Jerusalem happen when they're starting some new development. If they're going to dig an area for a new road, or if they do have to demolish some buildings to build something new, then they send the archaeologists in to have first glimpse of what's uncovered as the foundation is being laid. And that way, some very valuable artifacts have been found, even in modern times.
And then with only about a minute and a half here, Dr. Jastrom, tell us about the relationship of what we hold to be true based upon God's word as it has come down to us in the Old and New Testament, and the enterprise of archaeology. What is the proper relationship between the Christian faith and this art and science we call archaeology?
Well, one of the strange things that we said earlier in this interview was that these two fragments from Leviticus aren't all that earth-shattering. They simply have the same text that we've known all along. But that statement in itself is earth-shattering. The fact that our Bible is so reliable that these small fragments can be discovered that you can hold in the circle that your index finger and your thumb would make, and on the basis of a few words preserved in one, eight words preserved in one, the other one had about 19 words or portions of words, on the basis of those few words coming from 135 AD, we can find the precise location in our Bible and see that the readings have been the same since that time. That is the number one absolute top priority, showing that our holy writings have been preserved with incredible accuracy throughout thousands of years. No other holy work has that level of attestation, that level of accuracy.
Dr. Nathan Jastrom is professor of theology at Concordia University, Wisconsin, in Mequon, Wisconsin, and he has done extensive research and written several articles on the Dead Sea Scrolls. Dr. Jastrom, thank you for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
It's a pleasure.
When we come back from this break, we're going to spend, we're going to spend our second hour, at least the first few minutes, with Wendy Wright, Senior Policy Director of Concerned Women for America. Guess what we're going to be talking to her about? Yes, George W. Bush last night announces he has a replacement for Sandra Day O'Connor to the Supreme Court, John Roberts. We'll find out what Wendy has to say about this, what she expects to happen in the confirmation hearings, and whether or not John Roberts will actually sit on the court as Associate Justice. All that when we come back from this break. And then in the last 40 minutes or so of the program, Pastor Eric Rotman and Pastor Randy Asbury join us here in Studio A. An excellent conversation based around the latest issue of the Good News Magazine. Good News Magazine, Christ in You, the Hope of Glory, how Christ comes into you through His Word and Sacraments. That's coming up here in about 25 minutes on Issues, Etc. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.